thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule to join us today. We know that you're very busy with your practice and your teaching, so we very much appreciate it. For those of you who don't know, Anna Vrvaka, she's a homeopathic practitioner in Europe. She practices in Belgium. She trained in classical homeopathy in Belgium and in the Netherlands at the School for Homeopathy in Bloemendaal and Amersfoort. Hopefully I pronounced those correctly. And she also established the Center for Classical Homeopathy in Leuven, Belgium, which organizes a five-year training course, postgraduate course, yearly seminars, and an international training. Anna served as the program creator, teacher, and director for the last 15 years, and she's also been in private clinical practice since 1989. Now, Anna has developed her own style of practice, which she calls the AV method, and it's based on her 20 years of accumulated teaching experience, going to various seminars, and also investigating what goes on in her own private practice. The AV method is based primarily on the work of Rajan Sankaran, and it's combined with her classical knowledge and insights from phenomenology and linguistics. She coordinates international trainings and seminars, teaches, she offers postgraduate programs, and also online training. Also, Anna has published a few novels and two books on homeopathy in Dutch for the general public. Her English language publications for homeopathy, there are two titles. One is called The Charm of Homeopathy, which describes how she developed her method, the AV method, and then another title called The Postgraduate Annual 2006, which is a succinct overview of her method demonstrating its value in daily practice, both in adult and pediatric cases. So again, Anna, we know you're very busy, and thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, you're welcome.
Okay, good. So, I thought I would just start by perhaps asking you, since you've developed this thing called the vital approach, which I believe is a modification of Sankaran's vital sensation method, perhaps you could start by kind of giving us an overview of what is the vital approach. How does this work? How is it perhaps different or similar to Rajan's method? Give us an overview of it, please.
Okay, that's a good idea to start with. There are similarities with Rajan Sankaran's sensation method, and there are differences. Eh? I was a follower of Rajan Sankaran for many years, and I heard him announcing his sensation method, let's say, for the first time in 2002. And it was like a logical next step to the things he did before. Maybe it was some kind of childhood disease, I don't know. In the beginning, his sensation method was very rigid, I found. Rigid and strict, and maybe suitable for a more Indian public, but in my daily practice, I found it was making case-taking a little bit, how could I say, a little bit artificial. Like, we would try to get a sensation from the beginning on, and we would just focus on a word and then let the person repeat and repeat the word over and over again, and people didn't know what we were asking for, or we got stuck in this method, and I just kind of deserted the rigid method and developed or kept the good things about it and developed my own way of using it. By doing that, I must say that the results got better and better. So the similarity is we are still aiming for the sensation in a person, but the way of getting there in what I call the vital approach is a little different.
Could you be a little bit more? Could you give us an example, perhaps, so we could understand how it would be different?
Yes. Instead of trying to get the person to verbalize his vital sensation, to talk from the sensation level, to talk, make his source talking, which is kind of difficult, you know, and can take hours. What I'm trying to do, and what my method claims to do, is finding this vital disturbance on every level. So you can see what is vital in the physical symptoms. You can see the vital disturbance on the energy level. You can spot the vital disturbance on the emotional level and on the delusion level. And that's what I'm trying to demonstrate by my cases. So even if you don't make it until the fifth level, because a lot of our students got this feeling of failure, which I didn't like at all. Now, this is my, let's say, good news message. You can spot a vital disturbance on every level, if you know how, and I can teach you.
Hmm. Now, Anna, I know you talk about levels of experience, and you're referring to this right now. Can you give us a little bit of a better understanding of this idea of different levels of experience and how it works in your model?
Yes, I use this simple little scheme, but it's a helpful tool to imagine what we are doing, to make it visible, to visualize it. So I use these concentric circles of bodies, let's say, that a person has. The most central circle is then the physical body, the most dense body, and then the circle around it. It's enveloped in another circle, like Russian dolls, is the energy body that surrounds it, and that's the other aspect of the physique. And then the third level, the third circle, let's say, surrounding to others, is the emotional level. We all have it. It's our emotional body, you could say, where we experience our emotions, we exchange emotions with other persons. Then we have the level of the fourth level of the mental level, the level of our thoughts and convictions, and those are the two aspects of the mind. So one and two, level one and two is the body, level three and four is the mind, and then surrounding all this is the fifth level, and we call this the vital level, and it's my interpretation of Hahnemann's dynamis, when he says in his Organon, disease is a disturbance of the dynamis, or the vital level, expressing itself on mind and body. I interpret it. It's the fifth level, sensation level, which is disturbed and showing, expressing itself with signs and symptoms on mind and body.
Very interesting. Now, Anna, I've heard you refer to analysis in big categories. Yeah, in various locations. Can you give us a little bit of an explanation of what that means, analysis in big categories?
Yes, what I mean by this is when you gather your information from the patient, so the disturbances on mind and body, then you have a whole lot of signs and symptoms, and then you have to make an analysis. And I find it a tremendous help if you can first determine in which big category the person belongs, from which big category his remedy needs to come. So it can be a plant remedy he needs, it can be an animal or a mineral remedy, it can be an ozone. So if you can determine first the big group, then you don't have to look in every possible remedy. Even in your rubrics, you can reduce the possible remedies for this person to only one kingdom. If then that's one category. If you then can determine the miasm, then you know exactly what you're looking for. For instance, you need a plant remedy for this person from the psychotic miasm, which is reducing your possibilities a lot. So it makes your analysis a lot more sure and simple.
Mm. So Anna, when you first see a patient in your practice, the first thing that you'll do is you'll make the assessment of whether they need a plant, mineral, or animal remedy. Is that correct?
Well, it is maybe not the first thing, but let's say during anamnesis, the first part of the interview, I mostly keep silent and let the patient talk. Asking very simple questions like, what is the reason you're here? What can I do for you? What are your problems? Things like that. And then the person gives me the whole explanation of what is the things he wants to get rid of, what is his expectation of the treatment. And he explained me about his physical complaints or his emotional troubles or whatever. And the way he talks about these topics sometimes already gives hints to a certain kingdom. The way he experienced this particular problem, is it a matter of survival or a fight? Is it a matter of existence and meaning and values? Then it's mineral. First example, it was animal. Or is it a specific sensitivity to something? Then it'll be plant. So these little hints come spontaneously.
Mm.
And then later on, I will ask for them to confirm. But mostly in the beginning, I listen for these hints to a certain particular kingdom, yes.
Mm. And Anna, do you ever find that when you're taking the patient's case, that sometimes the way they speak sounds more like the animal kingdom and sometimes more like the mineral and sometimes more like the plant, and then it becomes difficult to determine which one, or is it usually pretty clear for you?
Not everybody talks only one kingdom, unfortunately. So, yes, as in most cases, you have hints to different kingdoms and hints to different miasms. In the same way, we have hints to different remedies. But as you go along during case-taking, something becomes repetitive and becomes confirmed, and the other things kind of disappear and are more common expressions. So in the end, they form a coherent pattern, the thing I try to explain in my book, The Charm of Homeopathy, that the vital disturbance makes a pattern. It is coherent. It holds together. It fits together. It's not loose ends, you know. It makes like, it's like an image or a picture and or a puzzle, and you get different pieces of the same puzzle.
Hmm.
So even if you get like a sentence or some hint for different kingdoms, there is always one that will, how to say, that will be stressed more, be repeated more, that will have the main, which is the main issue.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Was it any clear?
Yeah, no, very clear. And I'm curious, you mentioned miasms. I'm going to open up a little can of worms here because, you know, there's miasms is a term that's used differently by different homeopaths in the community, and
Yes. Certainly
the way that Hahnemann used the word is different than the way it's being used in contemporary homeopathic practice. I'm curious, how do you use that word? What is your understanding of miasms, and how does it fit into your approach?
Yeah, I must confess I was troubled by this problem that the Sankran miasms and the Hahnemannian miasms seem to be two completely different things.
Right.
And
right.
Of course, there are other authors who give another meaning to miasm. We have Harry van der Zee who wrote a book about miasms in labor, and he has another sequence of miasms. And we have the South American interpretation, where it's like the
sure,
core,
oh,
the original
yeah.
sin, you know that. And while Sankaran explains them as, or understands them as classifications of delusions, and the Hahnemannian miasm seem to be more, how do you say, a tendency or liability to some diseases and on a different level altogether. So it took me some time to think them together. And my conclusion so far, because this probably is a work in progress, my conclusion so far is that the Hahnemannian miasms are situated on level 2 of my little scheme, so on the energetic level of the person, and it's in resonance with the second dimension, which is mineral and viruses and bacteria, while the Sankaran miasms are coping up mechanisms of the mind. And they exist in the same person at the same time, because everybody has a mind and a body, eh? Does it make any sense?
Yes, very interesting.
I hear you're thinking.
No, I'm just listening. I'm waiting for you to finish. No, so, and how do you look at it, and how do you use it in your approach?
So, actually, I must say, the miasms, I don't use that much. I've been thinking about it a lot, and and reading about it a lot, because we're homeopaths, we're working with this, and
sure,
we have to teach it. Yeah, and there's so many different angles to approach this. We cannot just forget about it, but I'm kind of pragmatic in my approach. And so, is it useful or isn't it useful? And I find miasms are useful mainly in people who need a plant remedy. And then we, if we determine the plant kingdom and then the family, there's so many remedies left. Some families have like hundreds of possibilities. Thank God we don't have proofings of all those plants, but we have a lot. The majority of our remedies are plant remedies. If you read the Clark, there are over 800 plants, and there are only a few animal remedies.
Sure.
Of course, this was a lack, but still we have a lot of plant remedies. So even if you know you need a plant from the, let's say, Solanacea, then you still have a lot of choice. And how to differentiate them is by the miasm. So in that case, it's a big help. In a case of a mineral, we don't need them. I see authors who put miasm qualifications to the remedy.
Yes, actually, I saw recently there's a little laminated chart that Jan Scholten put out, and he assigned various miasms to different stages of the periodic table. I noticed that. So this is what you're talking about.
That is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, okay.
If you have a closer look, they just don't seem to fit, because you see on the left side, third row, we have alumina. It's, you know, traditional syphilitic miasm, and it doesn't seem to be in the right place there. And then you have fluor, and fluor is also syphilitic miasm, and it's on the other side of the chart. So it just doesn't seem to fit. While on the other hand, in Scholten's chart, we have 18 stages. And so we don't need miasms. We already have stages, and the stages are even more fine-tuned than the 10 miasms we use. Who needs miasms in the mineral? We don't need them.
I see. Very interesting. So let me just, because, Anna, some people may not be that familiar even with Roshan's methodology, so I just want to review it quickly so people understand what you're saying here. So basically, in your approach, the questioning process, from what I understand, is a little bit different than Roshan's, and basically you said it's a little bit more rigid and a little bit more adaptable perhaps to the Western populations, whereas Roshan's methodology developed out of India perhaps works better in that particular population. And then basically you'll kind of narrow it down to, you know, plant, mineral, or animal. And then if it's in the plants, then you'll try through the sensation of the patient, which runs through all the various symptoms, mental, emotional, physical, you'll try to identify a particular botanical grouping like Anacardiaceae, Solanaceae, Compositae. And then once you've identified that particular botanical grouping, then you'll try to determine the remedy within that particular grouping based on the miasmatic qualities of the case. Is that basically how you're working? Is that a good...
Yes.
I just want to make sure, because you know, people may not be that familiar with it, so I want to make sure that they understand how you work, basically.
No, I'm impressed you put it in 1 minute, in a few lines, which is absolutely great. But there are a few differences. What I meant to say by the method being a bit rigid, that's where I left Sankaran, that's what I meant to say. And
yes.
I kind of developed in another direction, and the difference became a bit bigger, I think, a bit broader gap between what he's doing and teaching and what I'm doing. So what I use from Sankaran, what I think it was a very good idea, a very helpful insight, was that what we used to call delusion, actually, and we were happily looking for the basic delusions in patients for more than 10 years, which was the deepest from the deepest, you know. And then Sankaran comes and he says, I'm sorry, there's not the deepest from the deepest delusion, there's something more. We have sensation. We have one more level. And all of a sudden, this made a lot of sense, because we had different delusions, and delusions are products of the mind, while sensations are like experiences, abstract experiences. So at that moment, he like divided delusions, of what we called delusions at that time, in different levels. This was great. This was a great insight, and it made perfect sense, and it was actually systematizing what we had already an idea of. We had the idea that there were different delusions, but we didn't have the idea of, oh, it's a different level altogether. And there's something beyond the delusion, and this was in line with Hahnemann's teaching. Because if we're looking for the delusion, then we're only working on the mind level. What about the body? And there were other homeopaths who say, yeah, we have to look for the confluent point between the mind and the body and the crystallization point, and the same coded message must be found in the mind and the body. Mm. And now Sankaran said, yes, because it's five, level five, just one level beyond. That's where the source of the problem is, and it's expressed in this and this way. Fine. So far, I'm with him. Yeah? But the way to find this vital sensation, that's where we took another direction.
Do you think this is largely because the type of patient population you're working with is different, or, I mean, because he developed his approach in India, perhaps, and you're working in Europe? Do you think that that's part of the reason that there's a difference? Because, you know, Anna, I teach in Japan, and when I think about you know, that the Sankaran case taking process method, you know, you really couldn't use that very well in Japan because people would shut down right away. They wouldn't take that type of persistent questioning process. So that's what I'm asking.
Yeah, well, they wouldn't take it in Belgium either.
Wouldn't, okay, all right.
The ones who take it are very limited. And because, you know, the people are kind of yielding here, so they would go along with you a while, and then they would say, but that's not why I'm coming. That's not what I'm trying to tell you.
I see.
See, at a certain point, they would just awake you and, like, would you mind to just listen to me, you know, instead of doing your thing? And it took me a few patients like that and a few horrible prescriptions before I got the message. Huh? I made my mistakes, and I think I corrected them. And, like, the attitude, like, we know better and we know what we're looking for and just answer my question was something I really disliked. So after a few mistakes, I started to listen very carefully to my patients, looking to the vital sensation and, let's say, being alert in their story. Not like, let me put a question, just be a good patient and give me the answer, give me your sensation, but just listen to the patient and understand and listen where their sensation is. On top of that, I thought the idea that there are three main kingdoms and trying to fit everybody in those boxes also was a mistake, because I saw patients who didn't fit in the box.
Mm.
See, and what do you do with them?
Mm.
So that's where I developed my idea of a pattern. Everybody has a vital sensation, a vital disturbance. That's the same. A disturbed dynamis is the same thing. And this is a pattern, and it will show itself on mind and body in the same way, forming a pattern. The moment I understood this, then I had the feeling, now I can see every patient, whether it's a baby or a toddler or one who doesn't speak or a patient who doesn't have any contact with his feelings, you know, or the patient who doesn't want or talks too much. Because if your system is limited to the good patients who are willing to follow you, what are you doing?
Right.
Yeah.
Very good.
So you can still follow the same method, see?
Right.
Even with a baby, it works. Yeah? It always works.
Right. So this is very interesting because we're focusing on the case taking process. And can you specifically tell us, in your approach, how does it influence the case taking process? Like, exactly what are you doing, and how is this method affecting the way that you take the patient's case?
Yes, what is typical for the method I use now is that, whereas before we were just waiting for something interesting to come, hoping that the patient would say something interesting and useful, now I have the different approach. Now I think everything the patient says is interesting and useful, even if he only talks about his swollen glands. If he wants to talk about his swollen glands for 2 hours, that's fine. Then the remedy must be in his swollen glands. It's clear now. So before I would just maybe get a little bit impatient. And when is he going to start and say something interesting, something deeper, you know?
Right.
And yeah, now I would just follow the patient where he takes me. If he had to wait for 2 months to see me and pay that money and you know, travel that far, and finally he's in my office and he starts about talking swollen glands, and for 2 hours, well, that's the focus of the case, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to ask, what about your mother and your father, and you see?
Right.
So what I do now is just follow the patient. What he chooses to tell me is defining the the territory. I wrote it in the charm also, and it's, I must say, waterproof. It's absolutely waterproof. The patient always takes you where the treasure is hidden, the treasure being his semilimum, huh?
Right.
Always.
Right.
You can trust it. You don't understand why he takes you there. You don't understand what he's talking, but if you follow him, he will just define the territory, and then once this has happened, and I demonstrate this with my students, okay, the territory is defined now, we interrupt the case, we agree on that, then we start to dig.
Right. Very
and
interesting.
Only then, only then we ask questions about the issues and the topics the patient mentioned. Mm. Nothing else.
Well, that's very similar to Hahnemann's approach in the Organon. That's kind of a...
Absolutely. I'm so happy that we're still in line with Hahnemann.
Yeah, it's totally in line with
that's
Hahnemann.
That's why I'm
yeah.
saying
that way
classic, huh?
Yeah. So I'm curious, Anna. You know, Rajan Sankaran's wife, Divya Chabra, has developed her own case-taking approach. I'm curious, have you experimented with that at all in your practice or used it to any degree?
With Divya Chabra?
Yeah. You
this
know, she
genius.
Has that whole word association case. I'm just curious if you used that
yeah.
at all or experimented with it.
Actually, I saw her teaching, 10 years ago or something in Holland, and I was impressed, and I invited her to Leuven
yeah.
to give a seminar. So she was here in Leuven for twice to give a seminar, and then she explained her circle method. Eh?
Yeah.
And I thought it was very, how to say, very detailed, very profound, and like step by step she explained how she got to a deeper level and a deeper level. And at the end she was left with, 7 to 12 meaningful rubrics, and then the remedy had to be there.
Mm.
And I tried it. I tried her circle method, but it was still in this period of, the basic delusion thing. So it had this mixture of delusions and sensations in her circles.
Mm.
And so one couldn't be sure, because delusion level is still a product of the mind, and we're not prescribing on products on the mind. I'm prescribing now on disturbance in the mind from the sensation level,
from
the vital level.
Good.
So it was good, but now I think we evolved one step further.
Good. All right. Now, this is a question, Anna, I like to ask everybody, because, there's lots of different opinions about it. And basically the question is there, in your opinion, one similimum for each patient or person that you see? In other words, there's just one perfect remedy, or do you feel that perhaps there are a number of different remedies over a period of time that can help a patient? What is your opinion on this?
Yeah, I know. This question is asked in every seminar. Yeah,
everybody gets asked that question. And everybody has an opinion about it. But I'd like to hear yours.
Yeah. Of course, I don't know. I don't really know. But as far as I can see, that if you have a semilimum for a person, it's his one remedy, yes. So there must be, and there might be more than enough proofs of that, there are many remedies that are close enough to do something, to have an effect on a patient. That's for sure. Many remedies will have an effect on one person. But as far as I can see, there's only one that cures.
Mm.
And cures, I mean, on that vital level, where there's a total transformation of the person, where you see this harmonizing effect in the mind and on the body, and where you see that the person is feeling okay with himself, and so with the outside world, it is only a projection of yourself, and there's so much, like the ego problems calm down so much that a person feels like careless or more or less careless. He has no worries because his mind is in harmony. So if you don't have worries, you don't have anything to think about or to worry about, because thinking mostly is worrying, isn't it? If you have no worries, what to think about?
Sure.
Then, they don't have all these emotional upheavals, so they're very calm and happy. I mean, this room for joy, eh? If you don't have your worries and insecurities and do they love me enough and am I okay? So if you don't have these feelings, then there's finally, there's place for other feelings. like enjoyment and happiness and being together and, you know, understanding how other people feel. And this maybe a patient comes because he has a blocked nose, you know. And I'm sure there are many remedies that can cure this blocked nose. But for this whole person, it's for in his inner core to harmonize, well, this is such a beautiful process to witness.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I could see, there's only one remedy doing the trick. Huh?
Mm. And so, Anna, in your practice, are you mostly just giving one remedy to your patients even over a very long period of time, or do you find that you need sometimes to change the remedy in the case? What is your experience with this?
Well, that was something I wanted to add to what I just said. Like, my experience is not long enough to make this point solid. See, I do have 20 years of experience, but my method changed, and so this vital approach, let's say, the way I use it is only like 5-6 years old. Like, now I really have a system. I can put it down on paper. I can tell exactly what I'm doing. I was doing it before, but not in every case, not knowing myself exactly what I was doing. But now I'm able to teach it step by step and can demonstrate it with cases, and I do these cases in public, etc. But still, it's not long enough. So the patients I've seen and I treated with this one remedy, when they do fine, and I don't see them for 2 years and they come back with some complaint, and you repeat the same remedy and they're fine again.
Mm.
And I have this experience myself too with my own remedy, which is the same for the last 6 or 7 or 8 years, I forgot. And if I change remedies, that's because I'm not happy, because I feel like it's not a similar one.
Mm.
Either I didn't find it the first time or the second or the third, I don't know, or I have a better idea now because the results are not satisfying enough, and also I'm evolving. The remedies I didn't even know or thought about a few years ago that I learned about now, and then I see, oh, this patient needs this remedy now. Our understanding expands, so it's a work in progress. It's not the final point now, huh?
Mm-hmm. Anna, a moment ago you alluded to something which was interesting. You said something about when you find that perfect similimum, there's a harmonization of everything in the person, mental. And so, could you tell us a little bit about this, like what you actually see when you get this really fantastic remedy prescription and everything changes? Can you tell us, share with us a little bit about what you actually see in your practice?
Yes, because in the follow-ups and the evaluation of what you've did with your remedy, it's very important. I have to tell the students over and over again, it's the case management is as important as giving the remedy. Yeah? So when do you know it's a similimum, and when does the patient knows? So very often it's not a quick response, and it's sometimes so very soft and easy that they don't even mention it. We all know that. Huh? Mm. They come in after 2 months, the patients, or 6 weeks, and say, your remedy did nothing. Huh?
Mm.
And I didn't feel anything about it. Nothing has changed. And then you ask about the original complaints, and they might still be there, but the intensity is much lower. It's less. The intensity went down, and the frequency goes down. So that's exactly what you expect to find when the remedy is a similimum, that the frequency and the intensity of the chronic symptomatology diminishes.
Mm.
It doesn't disappear overnight, never to come back. We don't do that kind of things. Well, sometimes we do, but it's very rare. And even if a remedy works very quickly and the symptoms disappear, I don't trust it. Mostly they come back.
Mm.
It's like fireworks, and it's wow, and like you did something miracle cure, and very often you see that it just doesn't hold.
Mm.
So what the similimum mostly does is working long, softly, and curing permanently, as Hahnemann said. Huh?
Mm.
Very gentle. Even so gentle that the patient might not even be aware of it.
Mm.
But he will. After a few months, it will be clear.
Mm.
But it has to be clear to you that even after 6 weeks, when the patient declares he doesn't feel any change, that the remedy is working. Sometimes it's not on the level of the main complaint. He might have, let's say, the blocked nose example, And he says, my nose is the same and nothing changed, but I feel more calm and my sleep is better.
Mm.
Then you know for sure you hit the core of the case.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's level 4 and 2, already going better.
Mm-hmm. And Anna, your approach to potency and dose, are you using C potencies, LMs? What is your dose approach with your patients?
Well, you see, I'm a traditionalist. I'm raised with the fifth edition, the Kentian Hahnemann organon edition. So I'm used to C potencies and K potencies.
Yeah.
I had this discussion with my students of the training every year. Why not LM potencies? Because we teach them that the Hahnemann himself wrote, this is superior to all I did before, and I rarely don't use them. But it's just a matter of habits.
Sure.
I don't say they're better or they're worse. They just work fine. It's only one dose, and the patient can go home and don't take anything for 6 weeks. Mostly it's 4 to 8 weeks, so 6 weeks is average. And then they come back, and very often this one dose is still working, and I give a placebo, and very often I don't have to repeat before 3 or 4, 5, 6 months, one dose.
Yeah. And on a mostly higher potencies, the 200 and higher, or?
Yes, 201 M is the most common I use. Use any potency from 12 to 50 M if necessary, but 200 and 1 M is very common in my practice.
Most typical. Okay, good.
Yes.
And also, I know that Jan Scholten, he lives there very close to where you are, and his approach is very popular in Europe. I'm curious, do you use much of Scholten's model in your practice?
Oh, yeah, I think his work on a periodic table is very useful, and his little scheme, it's so practical. And you know, with his books, the book Homeopathy and Elements and the Lanthanides, when you look at them in the beginning, you think, well, this, I don't like this, it's a few hundred remedies, names I can't even pronounce, I never heard of. You close the book, you put it in your shelf, and you hope you never have to use it again. But the more you see the cases, and the more you use the book, the more reliable it seems to be.
Mm.
So I learned to rely on what he writes there. It's very helpful.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I use his, not only his hints, because I have some different approaches in some details on the explanation of the rose, but it's mainly in the words. So where he puts relationship as a third row characteristic, I think it's a little bit confusing, etc. But the overall idea is very helpful.
Mm. Can you tell us, you said that you've adapted it to your own way and a little bit differently. Could you explain that a little bit further?
This also comes from practice, you see.
Yeah.
Because you have these themes, and it's not exactly what we're doing. The risk, if you follow this Scholten and you don't combine them with the vital sensation method, or the vital approach, as I call it, then the risk is that you get stuck on an emotional level with it, and you prescribe on situations rather than on experiences. So the person will give his story, his complaint, like he has a relationship problem, and then the risk is that you would prescribe on the third level, because Jan Scholten puts relationships as a third level issue. But that's not enough. That's the story. It's only level 3. We have to have the message in the story. So in this event, in this anecdote, in this story in his life, what is his sensation? See, if you use it literally on the words, then you go wrong. If you say, okay, level 2 or row 2 is about friends, or about level 4 is about, or row 4 is about city, or what is it, and work, then you go wrong, because everybody has a work and a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So you only prescribe then third and fourth row remedies, because that's a situation. But we're not prescribing on the situation, but how is your experience in this situation?
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Anna, you know, there's been quite a bit of discussion in the homeopathic community over the last few years about how the new approaches fit into overall homeopathy. And, for example, Jaiwar Shah, you know, the person, Indian homeopath who works with Rajan, a number of years ago wrote a letter where basically he said that the new approaches are fantastic, but that the student of homeopathy should get a foundation in the classical approach first, and then should build from that approach to using these new or integrating these new approaches into the classical method. And he actually made this a very strong statement, something to the effect that if all of the books in homeopathy were destroyed except for one, the one that he would retain would be the Organon. So that was, I thought that was a very interesting statement coming from Jaiwar Shah. And then recently, in an American journal called Smilamum, homeopathic journal, Rajan Sankaran was quoted as having said that he now feels that actually you don't even need the foundations of homeopathy, that these newer approaches, I guess he must be referring to his method, is completely inclusive and is functional without any other type of knowledge of homeopathy. And I'm curious, what is your opinion about this?
Oh, you can be
it's
sure.
It's a tough question. I'm sorry, but I have to ask tough questions.
What did you say?
I said, I know it's a little bit of a tough question, but...
No. We have this discussion here, of course, in our training, because
yeah.
we have teachers who go to Bombay regularly
yeah.
and who come home with this idea that, you know, all this basic stuff of materia medica and repertories, all, not necessary. We can do that later. We have to start with the method. And I have my doubts, because as far as I can see... And I will also defend this idea. As far as I can see, the method, the new methods, are based on the classical rubrics. And because we are trained with the classical rubrics and materia medica, we know where it comes from.
Hmm.
We can see it's thanks to the computer software that you can do search to the whole library and then find similarities in certain groups and families, and then you can make your conclusions. So, but it's all based on the data. Homeopathy, as far as I can see, typical thing about homeopathy is it's a healing system that is based completely based on subjective symptoms by volunteers who take in the remedy and then tell somebody else to write down what experience. So it's an inner subjective experience of a certain substance. Eh? And this is our body of knowledge. These are our tremendous amount of data. And then we try to find some system in there. But the system we have now is based on it, completely based from data material. And I have my doubts. If you leave out this and you start to teach the student, first the big categories, it sounds a good idea, and then go to Wikipedia and, get your knowledge from the substances, from the natural sciences and biology and whatnot, then you have a whole different kind of information, because then it's objective information with a scientific gaze from the outside. Do I make myself clear?
Yes, I think.
Which is completely different than the subjective experience of the substance.
Mm.
These are two completely different things. And I'm not saying that there is not an objective aspect in homeopathic remedies. For sure there is. If you take in a remedy, or the volunteers take in a remedy and they all get congestions of the head, well, it's something you can see. Eh? But there's some things that are visible or measurable, but the main body of the homeopathic data is based on subjective experiences of the person, individual experiences, different from somebody else. So you cannot replace the one for the other or reduce the one to the other. And on the other hand, I think in my training, because we had the discussion, this is still so experimental. There is no evidence that a training like that would yield to a good homeopath after a few years. So I wouldn't, I wouldn't dare at this moment to do this with my students. like, oh, we're going to forget all about the basics, and we give you the new method, and then later you can read your Materia Medica. And as far as I can see, at this moment, absolutely, it's not a good idea. If you can't make it to the sensation level, if you cannot find the vital sensation, but you can work with all your classical tools, you understand your homeopathic language, you can find your way in a repertory, you know how to use a Materia Medica, read the proving, do a proving, then you have your basic tools in your hand. The new method is the next step, but there are many steps before that, and I'm still convinced that it's necessary to take the first step before you take the second and the third.
Oh, well, thank you for that. You know, I asked that question because a number of years ago, Anna, I was at a Scholten conference where there was a woman who had been practicing homeopathy for over 20 years, and she had been following Jan for the last, I don't know, however, 15, 20 years, whatever, and she had never read the Organon even once, and I was surprised, you know, because how could you call yourself a homeopath if you've actually never even read the Organon? So I really appreciate that answer. Yeah,
I know. It's and the book is the more you read it, the more it's reliable. The more you have it's a support when you're in doubt. Many times the answer is in the Organon.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. So Anna, we're running a little bit short on time, and I want to give other people an opportunity to ask some questions. But before I do that, could you share a little bit about the two books that you've written in English in homeopathy and what those books talk about, and also. I know you're coming to the United States. I think it's in March. Could you share a little bit about that? Any information that people could get in terms of finding out more about the seminars or any books you're coming out? Anything, any of your projects? Please let the people on the call know so we know what you're doing.
Sure. So you already mentioned the Charm of Homeopathy and Postgraduate Annual 2006. So the Charm is the book I referred to before that, where I explain that, as far as I understand, the language of homeopathy is symbolic. So our categories are also symbolic, and this vital disturbance we're talking about makes a coherent pattern, which is also symbolic. It's pattern matching, and it's a matching with the symbols of homeopathy, the symbols of the patient. Anyway, I explain in the book, I hope a little bit more clear. And it's a part of it is theory and a few cases to demonstrate where I got it, from where I got it. While the postgraduate annual mainly is the life cases we did here in the postgraduate course, which we call now the masterclass. And it's cases, it's a short introduction of 20 pages of the method, and then it's the cases, the full text with comments. How we made the analysis, why we, what rubrics we use, what hints we use for kingdoms, etc., and the follow-ups. Now, the next book that should have been ready and will be available one of these days is on ozone, because I've seen so many ozone cases in my practice, and I had the feeling they were somehow overlooked, like the second line of the second row of the periodic table. All of these remedies are regularly used or common, like carbon is common, nitric acid, nitrogen is common, fluoric or fluoric acid is common, and then oxygen or ozone is like overlooked. And I've seen it so many times that I thought it was a good idea to give a collection of cases. And again, it gave me the opportunity to explain my method and give a few waterproof hints to find an ozone. Now I'm sure if you read the book, you can recognize an ozone from far.
Anna, you know, that's very interesting because, you know, there's more oxygen in the body than any other element. The human body, I think it's about almost 60% oxygen. And the next element is carbon. So and then
absolutely.
Nitrogen. So it's not surprising that ozone would be a remedy you would see in practice so frequently because it's such a major component of the human body.
Yes, it must be frequent. Yeah. My understanding, it's a polycrest, but it's somehow overlooked.
Yeah.
So as I said to Dale also, whereas I've I feel the charm of homeopathy is adding to the grammar of homeopathy, the understanding of the system. The ozone book is an adding to the vocabulary of the homeopathy. So it's knowledge on one more remedy.
Mm.
And the next books to come, one is in Dutch, and it's the masterclass annual. It's again cases with extensive question and answer sessions in between, intertwined, like why did you ask this and why didn't you use this word for a hint, etc. And we are working on like a manual of the vital approach, like in detail, what I'm doing, what is the, mainly what I explain now in this hour. And let's say, so I'm doing a lot of seminars abroad, but in the States, we'll be there, with me and my colleague Crystal, from about the 28th of March next year. We'll go to Boston, Massachusetts, and have a seminar there, and then we fly to San Francisco after that, and we'll be in the West for about 2 weeks, I think. Go back
Great.
Home.
Well, and you don't have the dates yet, is that correct, Anna? We don't have the exact dates yet.
Yeah, between 28th of March and 22nd of April.
Okay, and is there any contact information yet, or it's not prepared yet for more information?
It's a bit early, but any information can be found on my website. It's www.thewhiteroom.be, and then a section of it is in English.
Okay, very, very good. And we'll also post it up on our website as well once you've got the specifics.
So, and there I have my seminars announced and, you know, my agenda for next year. So it will be updated as soon as I have the exact dates.
Fantastic. Anna, is there anything else you'd like to share with the audience before I open it up to general questions?
Well, I think I said.
Okay. Well, listen. Thank you so much. It was a wonderful interview. Let me give some other people an opportunity to ask some questions. So hold on 1 second.
Okay.
Hi. So does anybody have a question they'd like to ask Anna Vrbaka?
I do.
Yes. Please go ahead.
Hi, Anna. It was a very interesting discussion.
Thank you.
A beginning student, and I'm trying to teach myself, so I don't even know where to start, really, because everybody has their approaches. But I guess classical would be probably what you would recommend. I wanted to know if you ever take cases long distance.
I haven't done it so far. You mean on Skype?
Or just by phone.
By phone. I would like to see the patient because that's very important. People sometimes call me and ask for an appointment for the baby, and then they ask, do I have to take the baby? Of course you have. I have to see the patient.
Mm-hmm.
it's important. Yeah. I think observation is a very important part of case taking.
If the person who asked the question is looking for a homeopath in their area, you can contact us and we'll try to find somebody, perhaps local, who could help you out.
Okay.
Yeah.
All righty. Other questions for Anna Vrbaka?
Yes, I have a question.
Please go ahead.
Yeah, I'm curious. How does your system work with the nonverbal or children with severe disabilities?
Yeah, I understand the question. Yeah, let's say if a patient can't talk, let's say baby. Yeah. Basically, it's the same. Then the mother or the father or the patient who accompanies the child will talk about the patient, and then they will explain how he or she behaves, what she does, what she doesn't like to do, and the peculiarities. And this will be combined with your observation. So you base yourself a lot on observation. What do you see? This is, as Hahnemann said, one-third of your interview is based on the observation, one-third on the report of the patient, and one-third on the bystanders. If the patient can't talk, then the two-thirds are on the bystanders. Yeah? So by the behavior, the likes and the dislikes of the person, and the interaction with his environment, with his parents or caretakers, then you will have to understand from which disturbance this is the expression. Do you follow me? It sounds more difficult than it is, actually.
Anna, did Renee do any video of any of your work so that we could put it up on the website? People could see exactly how you would do this? Because I think it would be very interesting.
Renee did a little interview, but it's not.
It would be very nice for us to, if Renee could videotape you doing taking the case of perhaps a baby, and then we could put the short clip up, and then people could. I think it would be very helpful for people.
Oh, okay. I will tell the suggestion to him when we have the baby here.
I think that would be great.
Yeah, why not? Why not? That's a good idea.
Good. Okay, good. Other questions for Anna Vravaka?
Well, touching on what
animals.
The last...
Yes, please go ahead.
Touching on the last...
The gentleman who's speaking, go ahead and ask your question.
Yes, what about... I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
What about animals? Do you take any animal cases?
I personally don't do animal cases, but basically, and I know how they sound, and I don't mean to be rude, but it's the same as with babies. They don't talk, but they behave. And it's their boss, the animal keeper, who will tell about his character, how he's behaving. And of course, with the animal, you don't go for the vital sensation. It will be mainly be expressed on emotional, maybe, if you can call it from an animal a mental, but let's say emotional level, 1, 2, 3. That's where your prescription will be based on. With a baby, it's different, but very often you will have to use the information or the state of the parent to confirm your prescription. And this you don't have with an animal. So I don't do it myself, but we have teachers in our school who demonstrate this.
Very good.
Does that answer your question?
Good. We only have a couple of minutes left, so... If you've got a question, please go ahead and ask it.
I have a question.
Please go ahead.
You said, Anna, you work mostly with, 200C and 1Ms. And I was wondering, do you try to avoid similar aggravations with, your very sensitive patients?
Well, we always try to avoid aggravations. And I must say, I see them rarely. I don't see many aggravations with my patients in general. Sometimes the patient warns me, like, I'm very sensitive to homeopathy and I had adverse effects before, etc. Then I might go lower, just to check out. Because it happens that the person is more than average sensitive to homeopathic remedies. It was already known with the founding fathers.
Thank you.
Okay.
How low would you go?
Good. Other questions? We still have a little bit of time here, so we got about 1 minute left.
How low would you go on your potencies?
How low would I go? You mean potencies, I understand. 6C or something, 6 to 12, that must be the lowest.
But that would be repetitious doses in those cases, right?
Yes. Let's say acute cases.
No, chronic. If someone warned you that they were sensitive to remedies and so forth, and you said that under those circumstances you would go low, so that means that you would go maybe with a 6C and repetitious doses in a chronic case?
And repeat often. I must say I would just wait for the reaction. If a patient warns me and then he said I'm very sensitive, and let's say I give a 12C, I would just wait for the reaction. And if it goes well without aggravations, then I would just go about, it was a higher dose, like every 6 weeks or whatever, I feel it's a stagnation or some kind of relapse or the remedy wears out. So it doesn't have to be, or if it's a matter of sensitivity. In the case of an acute, that's a different story, but that was not your question.
Okay, thank you.
Is that Carl Robinson? Is that Carl asking those questions?
Excuse me.
It just sounds similar to Carl. Okay, so I see that we're at the official hour, and I want to thank you again for taking the time out of your schedule. You've got a lot on your plate, and we very much appreciate you sharing your experience and wisdom relative to your studies and practice of homeopathy. Everybody, can we give Anna a big North American thank you for having joined us today?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And thank you very much, Anna.